Okay, so there is a problem with this talk. Problem is, it was scheduled for tomorrow at noon. I thought I should add to my usual presentation, general ideas of quantum information and optimal control, some specific part to quantum speed limit, because there is going to be a discussion. Okay? And then David said that there are some organizational problems for which my talk had to be moved to today. But my nephew, who is here with me, he's actually studying math in the library, wanted to go to San Francisco. So I had to leave very soon after David told me, okay? So what I did is I put some more stuff in the talk, but I was not able to remove stuff, okay? So it is now, I think, a 54 transparencies talk. I can do it quickly, okay? And it is supposed to tell a story, so it is more to give a flavor of different examples of what I'm going to tell you. And so, let's just start with it. So the idea is I want to apply optimal control ideas to quantum computing. And this is something which I'm doing in Ulm.
You don't have to talk so fast.
No.
We have all that.
Okay, very good. Okay, so.
No, there is 1215. That's true. That's true.
As far as
okay.
That's true. But you can start talking slowly.
I can adiabatically move. Yeah. And then there will be some wiggles in there.
No,
okay.
I do optimal speed
adaptation. Okay. I will do an optimal adiabatic brachistochron, as it has been proposed by Zanardi recently. So, I need to introduce. Since many people here, I saw many questions about quantum information, and so I would like to give a bit bigger introduction than I do usually on what this is and what we need to implement it. Then I will talk about what one can do with quantum control. I will describe some ideas on how you generate entanglement in systems, mainly from AMO physics. And then I have, this is a theory workshop, but I have several contacts with experimental people. When you talk to an experimentalist, the thing they do is they complain. Okay, so I come up with a long list of complaints and then fixing them one by one. And then, you know, I get very excited because I can fix them. And so, you know, I think, okay, let's overdo it. And I would like to see how much one can, push the limit of optimal control. And this brings me to talk about the quantum speed limit, which is also going to be the subject of today's discussion. So what do we need for scaling up the number of qubits in a quantum computer? Well, a quantum computer is basically a string of bits of qubits, which are prepared in some initial quantum state. Then they are operated upon by some unitary transformation, and you get some output, which then you can read out. And hopefully this output contains the answer to some interesting problem if you have done some interesting quantum algorithm in here. So what are these qubits? They are spin-on-half systems. They are two-level systems. And they can be, typically, they are in entangled states. So it is non-trivial to simulate the state of this. And this is why a quantum computer can do much better than a classical computer. Now, what I am concerned with is what stays inside this box. And what is inside this box is the composition of the general unitary transformation on all these n qubits into smaller parts, one and two qubit operations. So single qubit gates are just addressing individual qubits and performing a unitary rotation on them. With AMO systems, this is the easy part. You can do it with a laser, which addresses one of your atoms or ions. Difficult part is entanglement, entangling two different qubits. Good news is if you want to build a general quantum computer, so a box like this, you just need to be able to do single qubit operations of an arbitrary type and just one type of two qubit operation, which can be a control not gate like here. It is a gate that flips the second qubit if the state of the first qubit is one and does nothing otherwise, or it can be an equivalent two-qubit gate. For instance, what I will concentrate on is a phase gate. So let me see if I have it here. No, it's on the next transparency. So this is about how you realize physically such single-qubit operations with internal states of atoms. You can couple them via lasers, and of course you need to address individually these atoms. But this is something which is coming up more and more for a wider range of systems. It is something which is known how to do with ions, and now there are ideas how to do it also with atoms in optical lattices and in other systems. Now, the more difficult part, as I said, is entangling. So I have this array of qubits. Here, time is flowing. And what I want to do is basically to have some sort of time-dependent and state-dependent dynamics in such a way that at some point in time, two qubits will meet, they will interact, but in a way that is dependent on their internal state. In this way, I can get a logical interaction, so a quantum gate which has something like a truth table, okay, where the outcome depends on the state of both inputs. And one way of doing that would be to obtain a phase, a so-called two-qubit phase gate, where a phase is attached to the state of the two qubits only if they are both in a certain combination of internal states, like in this case here. I could realize that if I had a Hamiltonian which just imparts an energy shift here to the state of the system only if the internal states of both qubits are in a certain combination. I can try to engineer in practice systems like that. It is difficult. The difficult part is that there are other degrees of freedom, like here, which are involved, and this makes things more complicated and more messy. There are some quality criteria that I need to satisfy if I want to realize this type of system, quantum information processing system, with real physical systems. So I need to have a scalable system, so many qubits, and I can know how to build a system with many more. So if I can do 10, I can do 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 6. I need to have a way to initialize them. I need to isolate them from the environment. And also, I need to have a universal set of quantum gates. And those two things are, you know, somehow contradictory, because I want to isolate my qubits, but I want my qubits not to listen to anything in the environment, but I want them to listen very carefully to what I am saying, but I am sitting in the environment. Okay, so there are trade-offs which come out here, and those are the trade-offs with which I will occupy myself, basically, for the rest of the talk. And then, of course, I needed to read out the state of the qubits, but this is something which I'm not going to touch upon here. And I need to do all of this with a quality, with a fidelity, so high that in the end, this system can also have built-in error correction and all the machinery which allows me to do quantum computing in the presence of errors, in the presence of faults. So for fault-tolerant quantum computing, there are different estimates of the quality of the individual operations that need to be done. There are estimates which say, the first estimate said you need to have a fidelity, an error like 10 to the minus 6 on an individual operation, or it could be 10 to the minus 4. There are estimates which are even bigger, 10 to the minus 3, or for some models, even higher. But the question is, this is very demanding. And and so we have some wishes that we want to fulfill when we desire to, you know, realize this with the physical systems. Not only physically we need many qubits and low decoherence rate, but due to the trade-off that I talked about before, we also need to do operations, gate operations, quickly, so that the decoherence does not induce errors during the operation of the gate, and with high fidelity, which means that we need to do precisely what we wanted. And there are different types of errors which come in. Errors that come from the fact that your operation is not fast enough, let's say. And so, you know, you allow time for decoherence to kick in and to degrade the quality of your system. So these are errors which come from operation not fast enough. But there are also errors which come from operation too fast. Because if I want to do a very, very clean dynamics, in many cases I would like to do some adiabatic dynamics. But if I'm doing it non-adiabatic, because now I want to be quicker, then I will induce some excitations in my system. And this trade-off between adiabaticity and non-adiabaticity is precisely where quantum control can come in and help. So ultra-cold atomic molecular optical systems are good candidates because they can be isolated from the environment, they can be controlled individually, and you can have, you know, intrinsic scalability, so you can have periodic potentials like in optical lattices. This is actually not a cartoon, but it is a simulation, basically, of the experiment that Immanuel Bloch has done in Munich with atoms in optical lattices, where he has a state-dependent optical lattice. So you can see blue and red correspond to the potential felt by different atoms. And here you see that there is a state-dependent dynamics such that a left blue atom will hit a right red atom, and this will give rise to pairwise entanglement here. Okay? This has been done almost adiabatically, and one of the purposes here for me is to show how one can go beyond that. Okay, so in practice, what does it mean to scale up? We can, you know, there are some people, especially in Canada, which say that they can do, they can build a quantum computer. Well, there are question marks, important question marks about that, but it is, I would say, safe to say that nobody knows really how to build a quantum computer because of the trade-off that I mentioned before, and also because of other problems which can be of practical nature. Like, for instance, if you have these, you know, ion traps. Now they are building ion microtraps on surfaces, on chips. So you need then to move around, to shuttle around ions. So you have to transport them around. And this is not easy because you want coherence, you want internal state coherence, you want the ions to stay in the ground state where they are, because this is needed then for operation and so on. So this is a specific practical problem that you have in many implementations. And also, more in general, you have again this trade-off between strong coupling to U and weak coupling to everything else. Now, my statement here is that quantum optimal control allows for finding solutions to those problems. Not general solutions, but you pick a specific problem, and then you work on it, and then you will find, most of the times, a good solution. And of course, the question which my friend experimentalists keep asking is, what is the robustness to all the dirt that they have in their lab? And this is what I will address here. So, what can we do with control? We can, for instance, so here is an example. We can, for instance, transport non-adiabatically a particle in a trap without excitation in the final state. So here, for instance, I have an initial state which will be, two particles trapped into minima. Then I have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which in this case is also state-dependent, so it separates the components for state 0 and 1. And then the final state that I want is one atom on top of the other in the middle of the two traps so that I can reach my phase via interaction, via collision. My goal here is to minimize the difference between the goal state that I wanted, so ground state, one on top of the other, and evolved state that I get. Okay? And now I show you a little example of how our good friend Krotov does it for you. So I'm not explaining for the n plus one time the Krotov algorithm, because here there are some of the world experts on that, and it has been discussed many times. What I'm showing you is the application for that. So I start with, this is the potential for the two particles in a relative coordinate. So I have a relative coordinate wave function which is displaced from the center of, from the zero, where the two particles sit on top of one another. And here, I have, to make things a little bit more difficult, the delta potential which reproduces the interaction that I can have among the two particles in a pseudo-potential approximation for the collision of two atoms. It is a contact interaction, so they talk to each other only when they are on top of one another. And so this is a singularity which implies that the ground state here will have a dip, as you will see in a minute. And I start with some guess. The guess is I'm ramping down in a somehow smooth way the distance between the trap and the center when the two particles are on top of one another, and I don't do anything to the trapping frequency, but I allow myself to modulate if it should be needed. So I start, and I have the forward propagation, and then I get a fidelity which is 87%, let's say, and then I go back and it is a mess. And then Krotov kicks in. The first iteration, I get these little kicks, which have let the fidelity bump up. And what then happens is that as I move back and forth, this fidelity goes higher and higher. And within a few more iterations, or the order of a few tens, I will get a fidelity which is of the order of like 10 to the minus, an error which is of the order of 10 to the minus 6. Okay? Sorry? What do you mean, how do you change the, this is the physically. Yeah. Physically, in an optical lattice, you do it via you have the two lasers that are counter-propagating are linearly polarized. You change the angle between the two, and so if you decompose the resulting standing wave in circular components, you have two circular components lattices that are standing waves, but they move with respect to one another, and they talk to the different components of internal states because the couplings that generate the potentials are encompass an angular momentum change.
This is all for state dependent.
Yes, this is for the state-dependent problem that I showed before.
Excuse me?
Yes.
You're not trying to optimize the state-dependence part, right? Only the gates that happens given that you have a state.
I'm only optimizing the transport. So I'm optimizing a state-dependent process because nothing happens, basically, to the system unless it is in this combination of internal states. Of course, I can use also the more recent ideas that have been developed by Ronnie and Jose Palau in order to optimize a more general situation, including all the different four channels, 00, 01, 10, and 11. And there are ideas that we are currently discussing here in this workshop with Christiane and Niri Vala on how to use some work that has done with Brigitte some years ago, in order to optimize in general, leaving aside the unessential phases, the global phases which come out in the interaction. Okay, I think this is all I wanted to say for this slide. And so this was just transport. So here there was no entanglement yet. It was just to show you that Krotov allows to do transport non-adiabatically. Oh, I should have said that the time scale for that is basically 1.5 oscillation periods. So what has been done by Bloch in the experiment is with some adiabatic moving, which is of the order of 100 trap times, and here we are getting an improvement in speed of two orders of magnitude, which eventually will lead us to ask what is the ultimate limit for that speed improvement. I think Vladimir had a question.
Why is the dynamical phase during this process?
I take into account the dynamical phase, but in this 2-qubit process, the dynamical single particle phases belong precisely to those inessential phases that have been described in general mathematically in this paper that I mentioned before by Birgitta and Giri and other people. And you can always undo them with single qubit rotations if you know them. Okay. So the important part here is that there is a non-linearity which comes from the interaction, which comes from the collision of the two particles. And since that takes place only if the two particles are in that specific combination of states that makes them collide, only in that case, then that non-linearity is what gives you the 2-qubit gate.
But you have to know the dynamical phase.
You have to know the dynamical phase, yes.
So how you are going to know?
For instance, you could measure that in an experiment in which the Ramsey experiment, let's say, in which you displace the lattice with a particle here, without a particle here, and then you go back and forth and you measure what would be the dynamical phase. This in an experiment is how you would do it.
Tommaso, do you have anything you can say about the mechanism that comes out of the optimization? In other words, how does the timing work, or it's very hard to say qualitatively why it works?
I think for this specific example, it is non-trivial to say qualitatively how it works, why it works, because this non-linearity, this delta potential messes up everything. Actually, in the next example that I'm going to show here, it is possible to say why the features that optimization introduces really help doing the process, and one can understand it qualitatively. So this is why I am now going to what I know that in the US I'm not supposed to say that this is what we call the adiabatic massage, okay? And so this is why I removed the title from the transparency, but this is the adiabatic massage. So it is an idea of massaging two atoms on top of one another so that they couple in an interesting way. And the idea is you have this double well potential here with two atoms. And now you want to do, here we wanted to address the first complaint by Emmanuel. He said, OK, I can do state-dependent potential, but this is difficult. give me a state-independent potential, okay? That does the job. And so here is a state-independent potential. So here depicted all four cases for computational basis states. And then what we do is this adiabatic massage. So we can change the asymmetry in this potential and also the height of the barrier in such a way that this state here goes up, and adiabatically you get a transition of the left particle from the ground state of the left well to the first excited state of the right well. Okay? And once they, and I want to do this in a state-independent way. Oh, sorry, I want to go back afterwards. And once they are here, I can switch on molecular interactions, molecular interaction by way of some external magnetic field. And so via a Feshbach resonance, I can achieve a phase that will give me my quantum gate. And all of this I can do adiabatically, both the transport and the switching of the magnetic field. But then it will take ages, okay? Because here there is some tunneling dynamics, which, as we know, has a time scale which is exponential in the inverse splitting there. So we want to speed up this process. And also we have a motivation because some friends of ours have thought that they would like to do this experiment, and they did it in the adiabatic version. So what they did was to transfer one particle from the ground state in the left well to the first excited in the from the right to the left. In this case, here there is a measurement of the of the state of the Brillouin zones of this lattice, which shows that you went to the from the ground to the first excited state, and this takes a few milliseconds. They have done a 2-qubit gate based on similar ideas here, not exactly the scheme that I showed before, but they wanted to do it faster. Okay, and I will show later the work that we have done with them to do it, to speed it up by a factor of up to 10. But now I want to show you what Krotov does to this system. So Krotov basically changes the barrier height and the asymmetry of the well with respect to the adiabatic guess that you would have in order to get an adiabatic process. You squeeze the adiabatic gas in time, and then you run Krotov, and Krotov, adds these little wiggles. And the intuitive explanation for these wiggles is that if you look at the situation here, basically what you want is that the transition from left to right doesn't happen just adiabatically, okay? But you would like to give a little bit of a push, of a kick, of an acceleration to the left atom. Down to the right well, and somehow this is reminiscent of what we had before, because also before in the simple example there was this feature which was intuitively explained, that the distance between the two traps, I should go even back to that. Oh my goodness, what I wanted to show is after the movie. Okay, so the distance between the two traps here was varied and had a little bump in the beginning, which will appear now, okay? So Krotov introduces a bump, which is basically exciting, giving a kick to the atom, and then a little acceleration, and then following the motion, and then a kick back, which is here, helped by some, again, also here, some parametric modulation of the trap frequency. And this is precisely what happens also in this other example that I'm showing you here, where one can relate the frequency of these wiggles actually to the energy splitting. So what in the tunnel splitting in the upper state, so that really what you obtain is that your system is massaging the left atom into getting just that little bit tiny amount of energy, which allows it to go to the other side. You can describe it in Hilbert space. This is something which I learned, of course, from Ronnie, in adiabatic is you follow one state, and the control does some spread in Hilbert space, but in a clever way, which you wouldn't, at least I wouldn't be able to design by hand, okay, with these wiggles. But then this clever way is such then that everything in the end refocuses to the state that you desire. And now I go to some experimental friend, and they start, of course, complaining, because they say, well, okay, but this is very delicately designed. I will never be able to realize that, because it will have noise, because it will have cutoffs in my pulse shaping systems. So it will not work. But then when I go to Ronnie, he says, well, don't worry, because there are many paths in Hilbert space, and if you take away some, it will work anyway. And of course, I don't believe him, but of course, he is, as usually, right. And I'm going to show you afterwards in which sense.
But could you please say what those pulses are
here? Yes. So here is the barrier lowering, so the difference between the barrier between the two wells in the initial configuration and during the operation. Okay, so basically I have a barrier which stays up and then goes down and then wiggles a little bit and then goes up. And then the other parameter, the blue one, is the asymmetry, which between the two wells, which is the offset between the bottoms of the two wells in the double well potential.
So you're changing the amplitude of the standing waves?
I'm changing the amplitudes and polarizations of the standing waves. It is a complex way to, I mean, it took me 1 week just to figure how, I mean, given this, I can obtain, how I can obtain this, which is my goal, changing the polarizations and intensity of the laser beams, and I need to add another polarization component and so on. And all the details are in this paper, we can discuss them later. So it is not simple at all. It is a very good question, of course, because it is, you know, technical stuff. But I have, of course, no time, because I'm showing you like a dozen examples like this, and I'm not able to go into the details of that, because the message is not that. I mean, I suppose you don't care about how an optical lattice works. I suppose you care rather how and whether control works, and this is the story I'm trying to tell you here.
It's interesting to know what you're able to control. Can you tell us that? I mean, if it's an optical lattice you're playing with, what knobs does it come with?
Oh, yes. Okay, so I can go, since this is also relevant, of course, for the physical part of your of what you have presented, we can talk about that later, if you like, but the essential parts are, as I said, intensities and polarizations of counterpropagating lasers. And given two or more counterpropagating lasers, in the sense that you can have two with linear polarization and one with circular polarization, this is what I'm using here, then you can basically, you know, study what is the shape, the profile of the standing wave, okay? And you can really massage it in the form you want by using basically these inputs that really correspond to knobs that you have in your system. So if you want to realize a specific configuration for your purposes, we can talk about that. Definitely, I'm happy to do that, and there are, you know, plenty of experimentalists who could be happy to provide even more. Okay, so here is a different idea. I'm showing this because, you know, I don't care so much about optical lattices either. You know, I care about finding people who can do quantum gates, and so I look for different systems. So, and here is quantum chips, atom chips. so this is work which I've done with Jörg Schmidmeier, and the idea here is, instead of moving the potential, to switch the barrier just abruptly and let the atoms fall onto one another. But again, you do it in a state-dependent way so that the collision between the atoms in here happens only if they are in a certain combination of internal states. And again, this is a harmonic. This is a cartoon as opposed to the previous one, because this is a harmonic potential. And I mean, no atom chip will be able to do this. And so Jakob Reichel and Ted Hensch did not believe that you know, you could really do this gate on an atom chip, and so we optimized it, and I will show it to you in the next section. And here we are trying to go beyond the limits. Let's say this is an ongoing project with Christiane, where we really don't want to move anything at all. We just want to flash some shaped pulse in such a way that two atoms sitting into neighboring sides of an optical lattice or maybe sub-wavelength trap get coupled in a selective way to different molecular states in such a way that if you define your computational basis states in, appropriately, taking singlet and triplet states as a decomposition, you obtain something that is a square root of swap, but in this case with no bottleneck associated with motion of the particles, but basically with just the time scale of this pulse that you can shape and couple the two atoms virtually into a molecular state. Now, there is a question, how much is the speed, the possible speed you can attain here? It relates on the details of the potential between these two particles, and this is work in progress, so I have no number that I can give you at the moment as to how fast this will be, but this was one of the motivations for us, for me at least, to go and look, you know, in general, what are the what is the speed limit for quantum systems that you can control. Okay, so here comes the list of complaints. It is still partial, so I invite everyone to come up with more complaints, because my claim is we can fix them. I will not bet on that, but but I'm pretty confident. So
we're going to be taking up a collection for you at the end of the meeting.
Very good. Thanks a lot. So, yes. So your tracking potentials are not harmonic; they are unharmonic. Like when I'm pointing this laser, it doesn't stay as I would like to, but it jiggles. Okay. And as long as my age is increasing, the jiggle will go on. Then, of course, I have these nice wiggles in my potential, and I would like to follow them. But it requires they are higher frequency than gate operations, so I can have limitations in bandwidth. This comes from Bill Phillips. So I was talking to Bill, and I said, Bill, why don't you do the experiment? And he and Trey said, well, yes, but we are not really sure what is in the vacuum chamber. In the sense that we cannot really measure exactly that optical lattice, because if we measure it, either we measure it or we have atoms in there and the situation will be different. So we don't know really. We are telling the system, please give us a very nice and symmetric double well potential, but we are not sure whether the system does. So could you please give us a form of the pulse that will work even though we don't know what is in the vacuum chamber? And if it was anybody else, I would have just laughed in his face. But since it was Bill Phillips, I couldn't. And so I wrote two papers in order to address that question. There is another question, which is, the computational basis states that you are using are some quantum states, which you try to isolate from the rest of the Hilbert space, just to talk to them. But you can have leakage, like you would like to have some motion in the relative motion, as I said before. But you can have coupling to center of mass motion, and then things get very, very, very soon non-adiabatic. And we want to address that. This is something which we are doing we finished basically with David. Then there are, of course, if you are in scaled systems like an ion crystal, you can have temperature effects. You can have what we call inhomogeneous broadening, in the sense that this is another version of not knowing really what the system is doing. You give a certain pulse shape, and the system is doing something else according to some functional which is not completely known. Can you still do something? And all of this leads to decoherence, which is our big enemy. We want to fight it. And so let's go one by one. So unharmonicity in the trapping potential. Here I will be flashing to you examples of different physical systems where I went to experts in that system. I said, please give us the most realistic model that you have, and we will try to fix that. Okay. So the first thing is, I went to Ted Hensch's group, and I asked them for a chip design which could reproduce this switching potential that I showed you for atom chips. And I wonder why, but when I studied physics, there were nice point-like wires. It seems that Professor Hensch, even though he's a very distinguished colleague, does not have point-like wires, but he does have these very ugly rectangular wires. So this is something which they designed based on what they can produce, and they are now, this is now in production, okay? So they are building chips for that. and so we took this, you see it is very unharmonic, so I would never believe it can work. Then I go to Kurotov, and Kurotov massages with the transverse confinement frequency my system in such a way that even though I have to do it a few times, and even though in the intermediate revivals it doesn't really go up to fidelity 1, in the end it does go to fidelity 1, actually this is 99.7, and the phase goes to the pi value that I wanted. Okay, and so it seems that one can fix unharmonicity. Now, noise. So I go to Philippe Conger, and Philippe said, oh, very nice system here. He has some holographic traps to do this double well potential, so it is not even an optical lattice, you can control it very well, but he has noise, okay, like if I did it with my hand here, and he has noise for laser intensity, which is around, wiggles, intrinsic around 10 to the minus 2. Of course, he could try to stabilize and so on, but this is very difficult. And so he says, can you do this system? Can you optimize the system for me? So I do it. And then he says, well, what happens if you have noise? And I say, well, let's talk about that in the next paper we write. And he said, no, but I would like to know it. And then I say, well, it won't work. And then I do the simulation, and indeed, it does work. So that even with this type of noise, the fidelity decrease is below the fault tolerance threshold.
You assume your noise is banded, though.
Precisely. This is but in my next transparency, I'm not. So this is thank you very much for this question, because of course here the answer is, you know, when my typical example, but it works only on a Mac because I don't have the movie for Windows, is when the Titanic was sinking. Okay, the orchestra was playing violin. Okay, so you could die happily listening to Mozart, and this was certainly an exercise of control. And it was possible, even though the energy that was moving the whole thing, including the violins and the players and so on, was much bigger than the energy that you needed to move your fingers on the on the violin, you could do it because of bandwidth separation, okay? And of course, because of control and iterative improvement.
Other factors involved as well.
Possibly, but the main thing was bandwidth separation, and it is the same thing that works here, because this noise is 1/f. And it is typically important for kilohertz time scale. And so these wiggles, which are barely visible here, are much faster than the noise. And so what the noise does is something. Okay. And the little wiggles, which help, you know, this excitation from one well to the other, are not really distorted so much by that. And then you say, okay, now, because you are not, I know that you are not an experimentalist, but you can nevertheless complain. You say, okay, but what happens now if I have noise which is not separated in bandwidth, okay? And so I wanted that. So we shipped, I went to Rosario Fazio, who is a big expert on...
Can you look just back up?
Yes.
When you include the noise, do you do a density matrix calculation? Do you do a stochastic Schrodinger calculation?
No. This it is just single instances of... Yes. Well, this is what I did. But of course, given that the fidelity decrease is this, we tried different. It was not just one designed for the purpose. Okay, if you do many, and you do basically a stochastic average, this is what you will get.
So let's say you run the Krotov algorithm in the presence of noise, which is some kind of randomness. So then what happens from iteration to iteration? You use the same randomness as you had in the previous.
No, wait. So this is what we are trying to do now. So this is what you are talking about. What I'm showing here is the famous plug and pray method, which means I plug Krotov once, and then without noise, okay? And then I pray that when I put noise, it will work anyway, okay? Professor Kozlov says it will, and it does, fortunately. But I mean, it is not entirely clear to me. My feeling was it does only because of this, because I can also self-complain. So I thought it does because of bandwidth separation. Okay, and so because this is all a priori, we are not doing Krotov with noise. This is something which we are working on at the moment, and some of the last parts of what I'm showing will point to that. So, so I went to some people who have noise which overlaps with control in bandwidth. So I went to Rosario Fazio in Pisa, who is an expert on in superconducting systems. He shipped one of his postdocs to Karlsruhe, which is the source of knowledge about superconducting systems in Europe. And Professor Schön imparted him the knowledge on how to simulate 1/f noise with all that it needs to be done with microscopic fluctuators and so on, for what was in this case a simulation of a 2-qubit gate between two Cooper pairs, charged qubits specifically. So here is a red optimized curve for a quantum gate that does this operation here, and you see bigger wiggles and smaller wiggles. And here is the noise, which really, overlaps in bandwidth with the control. So we thought it is never going to work, because this noise has a certain, amplitude. And we all know that Murphy's law will predict that the amplitude of the noise will be just such so that the process is destroyed, okay? So we go to calculate the situation. And we compare the non-optimized version for different values of, as a function of the noise amplitude. Here is the error for the gate. The non-optimized is a couple of orders of magnitude, 1.5 order of magnitude, let's say, worse than the optimized. But of course, if the noise is huge, okay, then you know the error is 1, so you are sure that it is not working. And now your guess based on Martin's law will be that the real value for this amplitude will be somehow here, where the two are not distinguishable. But it so happens that Martin's law can be violated because the experimental values for these, you know, impressive experiments that they can do lies here. And so it lies still in a region in which Krotov allows to cross the fault tolerance threshold, even with realistic noise, even with noise overlapping with the bandwidth of the control. Do we understand that? No, I don't. Professor Kozlov says yes, don't worry. But still I worry a little bit. He worries. Okay, thank you. And okay, so do we understand this? No. And we are trying to get a more general understanding. And I mean, part of the reasons why I'm trying to, you know, I'm a user, as you see, of these algorithms. Okay, I go to people who are the source of knowledge, and I try to extract from them something useful for me. And this is one of the reasons why I come to workshop like this, and I'm getting a lot of useful information. So, please.
Really, all you're using here is the fact that the behavior of the system is going to be a continuous function of your control. So if you don't change it too much, that's what you're seeing there. That too much happens at 10 to the minus 3. So you got lucky this time.
That is possible. On the other hand, it is possible that there are also techniques which allow you, as it has been described in some of the more mathematical talks during this workshop, which allow you to filter your control or to impose some constraints in terms of bandwidth or something like that. So it is possible, along the line of what David said, to embody in your optimization to a certain extent the knowledge of the noise process, be it in terms of, you know, simulating the evolution of the system, including noise, be it just saying, okay, the noise has certain spectral properties, so I'm trying to stay away from that. And so here, yes, we have been lucky, if you'd like, but in the general case, there is still a lot of room where you can still improve and, you know, get away with
the optimal features. Control book technique for stability assurance in the face of noise is to use feedback control. That's
absolutely. The thing is, here I am talking.
Yes, measurement.
Exactly. Yeah. So here I'm talking only. So my whole talk.
Control without looking at.
Yeah. And then you're gonna.
This is a very important point, of course. And I should have maybe mentioned before that my entire talk is going to be about open loop control. And my statement is, even in open loop control, you can do better and more general, even in the face of noise. And I didn't believe it in the beginning. Lorenza has a comment.
I think I will pick up on similar issues in my seminar, hopefully. I am not an optimal control person. I'm more like existential, constructive, but open loop as well. And one of the questions that are not clear yet in my mind, as weird as it is, I was completely with you, like, yes, we need to close the loop to get the traction field. There is no question, we need dissipation, we need somewhere to have non-unitary action. Well, I'm trying to prove this, and I'm not getting there. So maybe that's, you know, I don't know. So this issue about the full threshold for purely open loop control, still not, I think the answer would be no. But it's an interesting problem.
So yours is a beautiful question, but it is still open.
Yeah. They do have another question.
Oh, yes.
And the question is, to all the optimal control people, actually, do you guys think it would be conceivable to use similar techniques for optimal control of a non-unitary or of a generic quantum operation, not just a... because here is what can go wrong with the unitary component of the evolution, which is, of course, a very, very, very important component. But suppose that we get to the point where we are limited by either the initialization or the readout capabilities, which both involve non-unitary processes.
Those people have already developed some algorithms to do that, some versions of Croto, for instance, to do that, for for dealing with the systems evolving according to a master equation, for instance, instead of a Schrödinger equation. I think that.
It's only half the question. The other half of the question, did we try to choose a target that's non-unitary? The answer is no.
Right, that is what I think. Bearing in mind the target, which is in general like a quantum operation of your choice.
No, no, but wait. For me, what David has done with the optimization of cooling is, you know, the target there is certainly a non-unitary operation, and you know, I mean, and he has done it. It is not general, okay, but certainly it is non-unitary.
Well, there is an answer in NMR. We have extremely well characterized non-unitary parts of the Hamiltonian. So that's being on a regular basis?
No. I'm talking about developing formal methods for tracking optimizing
one equation. You would say cooling is like state to state. You want to reach a final state. And what you want is the full range of. Full operator, non-unitary. This hasn't been done. This is an open question, and I think.
What Thomas has done is on my radar in terms of, you know, one of the next things I would like to understand, but at the moment, honestly, I don't. So I mean, it is an open question. I mean, people, the top people are working on it. And you know, I hope to be able to use it soon.
Could you tell me the time scale on this gates?
How
fast do you do this?
It was, I think, picosecond time scale.
So in a sense, you can beat the decoherence, which is coupled.
Yes.
What is the mechanism beating the decoherence?
Just doing it fast. No, my whole claim here is why do I say that using quantum optimal control is good for beating decoherence? Because it allows me to do high quality but fast processes, so that the gate takes place on a time scale which is much shorter than the characteristic decoherence time of my system, and in this way I'm just, you know, keeping away from the gate. The errors coming from decoherence.
So it is decoherence like on the order of 3 milliseconds.
I think in this case of this circuit here, the decoherence times are, I think, at the moment of the order of nanoseconds rather. Maybe in some cases microseconds. Okay. So there is maybe in the worst case a factor of 10^3 between this gate operation and the shortest known, you know, decoherence time. Or it could be better. But I mean, the whole idea for me, the whole motivation for me of using optimal control is doing it fast. Otherwise, I could do everything adiabatically, okay? But that wouldn't.
So, in a sense, you are not suppressing decoherence, just making fast gate,
yes.
Which will be faster than decoherence.
Yes. In some cases, I'm suppressing decoherence. In some examples that I'm not showing here, like some work we did with quantum dots, which was actually started here in Santa Barbara at a previous workshop. there we try to do some almost adiabatic displacement of phonons. And in that case, you have a spin phonon model which describes your decoherence. And in that case, you can really suppress it because you stay adiabatic in the phonons, and then you go back to the initial phonon state. But this is, let's say, that is a sort of a special example. In general, really what I'm doing and what I'm showing here is precisely what you're saying. So it is completely trivial, theoretically. Okay, there's nothing very deep.
You can only dance around decoherence like that if your controls are faster than the noise correlation time.
Yes.
That's extremely rare experimentally. I mean, certainly in magnetic resonance, we're always orders of magnitude slower than the correlation time. In the controls, we can impose.
I don't know.
The scale of NMR control is microseconds.
Yeah,
the scale of NMR correlation time is nanoseconds.
I'm not entirely sure that you need to be faster than the noise correlation time. If you are not, basically you are losing some information into your system. And the question is, how much is that information that you are losing important? How crucial is it to reach your goal? Okay, and it seems, maybe I'm lucky in these cases, but it seems that even in cases in which you know you are wasting away some stuff, still you get a good quality. And do I understand it in general? No, I don't. I would be thankful to any of the great experts who sit here if they could give any hint as to why that is the case. So, so on one hand, I'm very happy because it I have the impression that you know all these problems stimulate reactions. On the other hand, I have a lot of stories to tell. I can also stop at some point, but I'd like to move on. Fun because we can have more fun in case you like the next examples. And one known fact is, okay, now all these wiggles, so I keep saying, no, these wiggles, these ripples, they are so important. So, and then, I mean, one would expect, okay, if you are not able to do them, then, I mean, there is no hope. So one important question is, what happens if, you know, I give some very nicely modulated pulse on, you know, on top of the big tank. At the bottom there is this this squid system, okay? On top there is some wire that goes in. And in the middle there is a lot of electronics which will distort that, okay? Which will cut out some components, some Fourier components in my signal. So what happens if I constrain a posteriori again? So this is again the plug and pray, but I'm sure that one can do better with new ideas about constraining pulse shape during the optimization. But what happens in this case of the superconducting Josephson gate if I constrain the shape of my signal to you know a few up to 100 Fourier components? You see here that in that specific case, again, what happens is that with a few Fourier components, you are already around the fault tolerance threshold. Then, of course, if you want the full power of the control, you need of the order of 100 harmonics in your signal, but even with definitely less, you can do pretty well. Again, I'm not claiming this is generic, but I am saying that the naive intuition that one needs all those wiggles, and I can tell you that the shape of the modulated signal, for instance, in this case, is something like this. Okay, so it is definitely different than what you had before. You have some wiggles, but they do not really resemble the wiggles that you wanted to obtain. And still, the fidelity is good. So the naive intuition, this is just a counterexample for me, for the naive intuition that if you cut away Fourier components, it will not work. It still can. Under which general conditions? I don't know. And again, this is an open question for me.
I don't understand the second point on that graph. Surely some sort of variational principle must apply.
Here.
Why
oh no!
This force when you get from.
This is just by chance. So I mean, here basically you have something flat. Okay.
Surely you've got something slightly more flexible if you get Fourier components. It has to get that.
No, no, because what it says is the essential part of the control are the some wiggles which take place in this frequency regime.
But
so
if adding a Fourier component make it worse.
Exactly, that's my point. That's it has to be a monotonic curve.
Unless you hit some kind of internal frequency that is there for some reason, you get unlucky.
So you're actually pushing it away
right.
With the frequency.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you
question
can.
No, but you have it optimized,
no,
right?
I didn't optimize it for each point. I took the point, I took the curve optimized with this, and then I chopped. And then this can happen. Okay. No, of course, if I optimize with everyone, this should be completely monotonic, right? Of course. But this is not the. This is the. Okay. So this is the plug and pray. Remember, you know, optimize for infinite power limit. Okay, like in which you always win a billiard game in the infinite power limit, right? Optimize for that, and then chopped away stuff. Okay. Good. So and then I go to Professor Phillips. And then he says, well, okay, we try to do this transport process. We want to do it faster than we could. This is just to show you that this is real, okay? In the sense that, you know, there are some electro-optical modulators, there are some phase shifters, there are some parameters which correspond to real knobs that can get turned in Bill's lab. And here, in this region, you get the optical lattice which realizes that double well potential. And again, this is the reason why. So you say, okay, now I want a certain phase phi, which corresponds to a certain parameter in the potential, and you input 0.37, okay, like in the Monty Python movie, you input a certain number, and then what the system is doing is not exactly what you expect it to do. So you want to calibrate. In this case, one simple way to do that is just to calibrate. So it is a sort of feedback, but feedback in which in the feedback loop, you sit in the feedback loop. So Bill does some measurement, and he says, okay, I expected to have a certain value for this phi. I did some transport process. You measure the whole, you simulate the whole Schrödinger equation, and you try to, it is not really a fit because this is not a curve which depends on parameters, but you try to guess, basically, what were the real values of these parameters given that they have obtained certain populations in the final state, in ground, first and second excited state, and you try to guess what were the real values of these parameters here. And in that case, you can improve on the predictivity of your simulation. So basically, you find out that there is an offset between what they think they have and what they have. And then again, you can apply optimization and go down by one order of magnitude in time, and which without optimization would give a very poor fidelity, and with optimization it gives a fidelity which is not beyond fault tolerance, but it is still pretty remarkable, and they are planning on doing this. This is a paper which we published together last year, and they are planning now, Trey is planning on doing this experiment. So, again, another source of, I'm trying to stun you away with all the possible complaints here, and one is leakage. I'm doing this with David. So what is this about? This is about a scalable scheme for an ion trap quantum computer, where you have an array of ions and one ion going around, okay, and talking to each of the qubit register ions via some pushing laser that displaces the ion wave function in a certain state-dependent way. Similar to what I showed you for the optical lattice, but now the ions do not need to go on top of one another because they talk from a distance via Coulomb interaction. And if you do everything adiabatically, your trajectory in phase space in the relative frame will be just a point here. But then, of course, you are pushing the system around, and so it follows complicated trajectories. And these trajectories are complicated because here we are dealing with the problem of having a non-linear, non-harmonic system. So a system in which you cannot decouple center of mass and relative motion coordinate, because you are assuming that the push, the laser which does the push, really has the real profile that a real laser has, which is not completely homogeneous. And so it introduces coupling terms between relative motion and center of mass. And then this is leakage, because you are losing wave function to excitations in the center of mass, which you do not want. And again, you use Krotov, and you find some pulsing with some wiggles. So this is the difference between the some Gaussian guess and the optimized pulse for different lengths of your gate operation, and then you find that Krotov, as usual, allows you to obtain improvement by one to a couple of orders of magnitude.
In this case, leakage just means you just get a really big Hilbert space.
Yes. No. It means that. It means that I'm populating in a unitary way. But non-adiabatic, and then in the end uncontrolled, because I cannot cool it down, the center of mass motion. Okay, and then I don't know how to get back the wave function and push it in the relative motion.
You would like to have something non-unitary, but it's unitary.
Yes. Okay, so, and again, one gets these very regular wiggles, and so one is tempted to try and use them, by hand. Okay, this time in some, because this is basically Gaussian plus some oscillations at a higher frequency, and so one could try to use this without Krotov in a case like an ion crystal, where we have in this case the effect of finite temperature. So here we are trying to do this push gate, not among one head ion and ions in the register, but between any two of the ions in this ion crystal and a panning trap. This is what we call a quantum hard drive, because this is rotating, and with this moving this laser, we can write some interesting state, for instance, a cluster state onto the crystal in a single sweep. But the problem is this crystal has shear modes, which are very soft, okay? You can calculate, but they have very low energy, and so they get populated very quickly. And so you could think, okay, let's take the naive pulse, which would be Gaussian pulse, and introduce some wiggles exactly like those that I showed before, but this time just by hands, okay? And try to calculate, so this is the pulse shape that you get, and try to perform gates with these faster oscillating pulses in such a way that basically you decouple, you are not talking to those low frequency polymers. They have no time to react. And what happens is, again, that you get, you know, a very, very low fidelity, very, very low error, high fidelity, even for considerable temperatures and definitely realistic temperatures in such a crystal here. The idea here is that come from the other side. It is not something that I gave to Krotov and then I can explain it, but it is something that I put in by hands and it does work, so that I decouple from phono modes. So, oh yes, so here is still yet another version. I think this is the last of my examples, and then I will go to the quantum speed limit if anybody is still alive, or I can postpone it to the as an introduction to the afternoon discussion. So inhomogeneous broadening, what do I mean by that? I mean that, so here I'm back to my transport problem with the harmonic oscillator, okay? And then I get some red curve, which is d of t, okay, which tells me that I can do this transport in a short time of the order of the period of the oscillator, maybe shorter. But then when I do the movement, I may make some mistakes. So really the pulse shape that the system feels is different than some functional of my desired pulse shape. And so it could be a linear functional in the sense that it is it plus, you know, let's say a discrete Fourier series, like this blue line. It could be non-linear in the sense that, you know, like I make mistakes only when I move the system. So there is an error which is proportional to the derivative, to the time derivative of the pulse, like this green line, which is non-linear in D. Or it could be that, you know, I have a finite sampling time for my control. So what my system does is just piecewise update of the like voltage on some electrodes in an ion trap. And, you know, I would like to be able to get good fidelity for all these possible distortions where the distortion is non-perturbative. So it is like it can be 20% the amplitude of this departure here. So, of course, during the transport from beginning to end, I get different wave functions. But in the end, all the trajectories get basically refocused down to the origin if I chose properly my transport function. In this case, it can be done analytically because this is a harmonic oscillator. And this is the main reason why I think the harmonic oscillator is something pathological. That works, but just because it is a harmonic oscillator, and this is one of the main experiences which make me not so confident that unharmonic terms will allow anyway this to take place. And here is a plot of the fidelity, okay, the projection of the desired state on the state that I actually get instantaneously, and you see that it focuses back to one at the end of the operation. So what we are trying to do, this is a project I did with Naveen last year. What we started this year is we are trying to do something like this with a generic model, so really a noise process and not just some you know, fake or toy functional that I'm putting in there just to see what my system tolerates. In any case, I must say that what the system is tolerating is much more than what I would have expected naively, and much more than what many of the people I talk to would have been expecting. Okay, so there is room. So that we are just, my claim here is we are just scratching the surface of what can be done, and there is really a lot that can be done. And so I ask myself, I mean, now let's overdo it. So how much can we really push? But now before I push the limits of quantum mechanics, there are also some biological limits to people's attention, which maybe it is not wise to push excessively. And so I am wondering what time it is.
Fine.
Is it fine? Okay, David is fine. Is also everybody else fine?
Well, you've been talking for an hour. And,
okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks.
You're
well trained. Sure. Okay. So,
maybe what does slow down a little bit?
Oh, that will be difficult. But I can do that. Okay, let's introduce some wiggle in the speed of this talk. There is a paper by Seth Lloyd and some Italian co-workers that talks about how fast can you do something in a, you know, it is this Seth's thing, like, you know, how much computational power can you get in a black hole, or if I have a pound of matter, okay, and I transform it into a black hole, how much can I do under extreme conditions?
Yes.
Yes. But I must say, I said that because normally, when there is this sort of extreme things, people tend to think, well, you know, this is a little bit like, you know, well, do I trust it? But this is for me a very reliable, you know, and useful thing that comes directly out of those reflections. So here I'm defending not only this paper but also the crazy stuff that Seth does, because it can be very inspiring. And here we are going to use it. Again, I'm a user, okay, of some theory that someone else has developed. And this theory says that if you have a static situation, now we will move then to we are generalizing that to time dependent, but we will do that later. If you have a static situation, is of course the speed with which you can go from one state to another depends on the dynamics. Okay, this is very trivial. And on what features of the dynamics? On the energy, which is in the system, so the initial state and expectation value of the Hamiltonian on the initial state, and on the variance. Okay, and this variance actually reminds me of what Ronnie always taught me, that you know, if you want to go fast, you know, you need to spread out in Hilbert space. So if I'm spreading out in Hilbert space, then I can get something. And then you can have the minimum time to reach an orthogonal state, starting from a certain state, is the maximum between these two inverses, inverse energy and inverse energy spread. This is the simple result by Seth, and we are going to apply that.
So the energy variance is with respect to the initial state?
Yes. Because here we are talking, remember, this is for a static situation, okay? Then if we wanted to apply to the typical system we have in mind, we need, of course, to have a mean, okay? And this is why this comes to the question I asked you about, you know, is the final time the inverse of the final splitting or the inverse of the average? And of course, it is the average, so it makes perfect sense.
Can you remind me what is the time energy, the Mandelstam kind of principle, how it relates to which one it is?
I don't know.
Delta I, delta T, not the usual one, the Sakurai textbook, but the one
that I'm not aware of.
Mandelstam time is something like that.
So. Thank you for showing my ignorance.
No.
I can show off my ignorance on many more subjects, but
there's a lot of kind of very cloudy stuff that's been written about the time energy uncertainty principle and what it means.
Because I was curious myself about this stuff recently, and I was trying to ask what is the relationship. That's why I was okay. I will find.
Maybe I will. I will ask you what this Mandelstam stuff
I
is.
I'll do so my I can bring it to the discussion.
Oh, beautiful! Sorry. So we can have it this afternoon.
A Gaussian wave packet here, and the Gaussian wave packet in Andromeda galaxy would definitely be orthogonal.
Yes.
However, the minimum and degenerate. However, the minimal.
Not in a static Hamiltonian.
Well, let's assume they're non-degenerate. But given the relativistic constraints, that estimate becomes meaningless.
I should have said before. I am here giving a talk about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and this is a workshop on non-relativistic quantum control. Okay. This is an important disclaimer, of course, right? If you want to be general. However, you know, I have no idea, and honestly, I don't care, because everything will happen, everything I'm interested in will happen in a rather small lab. Okay, and I'm hitting a speed limit much, much, much before anything gets, you know, orders of magnitude closer to the speed of.
But
okay.
So H is in general is going to depend on time.
In this paper here, it is not. In the generalization that we are trying to use to estimate, because we are interested in time dependent processes, we are trying basically to integrate this over time. Okay, and this will be the instantaneous state basically.
This paper isn't really in the context of control where you...
No.
Yeah.
No, what we did...
Yeah, it's just dynamics. So if you add a parameter, you can go faster, right? As, I mean, that you change in some controlled fashion.
Yes.
Then you can make it go faster.
Yes.
But this is both an upper speed limit and a lower speed limit.
What?
This is both an upper speed limit and a lower speed limit.
No, this is the upper. This describes them.
You can't go
the minimum
slower
time.
Than this either.
Why?
I don't know if that's the spread of your.
So let's say that in a it is possible that in a.
But it doesn't sound like this is even about targets. This work. This is just a statement of the time energy uncertainty principle.
That's why I want to get.
But it doesn't sound like this is. It's like on the highway where you say you can't go faster than 55, and you can't go faster than 65, and you can't go slower than 45. It's.
That's why I wanted to get the answer.
I think in a if you consider this strictly in the static situation, yes. Okay. But really what interests us is to try and use these ideas for a non-static situation. And so the simple example that we
excuse me, I have one question.
Please.
I'm not familiar with these problems. So in the theory, the initial energy is a very important factor to determine the fundamental speed limit, right? But we can always choose the energy standard. In that case, we can always change the value.
You are right. So
according to our definition.
Yes. So my understanding of this energy here is it is the energy relative to the ground state of the system.
So as long as you're in the, mostly in the ground state, that first term there is infinity.
You're in an eigenstate.
No.
This has not to be an eigenstate.
Oh.
If you say the second part is huge, and so your time would be, the minimum time would be huge.
Yeah.
So the point is, if you're very spread, then your mean energy is the limit for some reason.
But certainly, if it's not an eigenstate, isn't the speed given by the Hamiltonian cluster?
Yes, and in a way, those are the two first terms.
Yes. Yes.
So just my intuition would say there should be another part there with the third square root of h minus e squared to the power 3.
My understanding of quantum speed limit is perhaps more fundamental. I mean, it's a question of how fast can it ever get under a variety of Hamiltonians. And this is indeed just an uncertainty principle.
So there's a. In a certain sense, if I understand this correctly, it's really a very old result. And there's. In the time dependent formulation of spectroscopy, if you look at the wave factor, a wave factor. Autocorrelation function. For a normalized wave function, it starts at 1, and as a wave packet moves, this thing will drop down and decay. And the time for the decay is basically time to get into an orthogonal state.
Yeah.
And we know that the Fourier transform of this thing is the spectrum. The spectrum is just the Fourier transform of this, and if this is delta t, this is delta omega, which goes as 1/ delta t.
Well, indeed, that's what I was. This is exactly the Sakurai. You have the piece in Sakurai is that one.
Okay, so this is so basically, you know, and this here, the width of the spectrum, is basically just this.
So this is just, in my view, this is just stating that in more general terms. But still not completely general, because this only deals with a static system. And what really I am interested in is what would be the extension of this for a time-dependent system. And this is what is for me the open question, and what I'm trying to explore for different with different physical systems also of, you know, delocalized nature, like a spin chain. Like the main example I'm showing afterwards is how fast you can, you know, transmit, how you can use a spin chain to transmit a signal, a quantum state, from one end to the other.
So you would like to connect this to the Lee Robinson kind of?
To the Bose type of, Sugato Bose works on quantum communication via spin chains.
No, I'm thinking the Lee Robinson gap that you can have if you assume that the Hamiltonian has some local structure, as it's always the case for spin chains. You know, the light cone in but this is not relativistic, but the analog due to the fact that you have a finite speed necessarily if the interaction is local.
Okay. Good. I'm keeping showing off my ignorance. I'm not aware of that either, and so I will come to you and ask for many references. So the first, the simplest example of a time-dependent system in which we wanted to study this, to see how this behaves and how it relates with our optimization algorithms, in particular with our favorite Krotov procedure, was Landau-Zener. So what we have is here a system with certain coupling and, you know, an avoided crossing between two energy levels. And we start with a certain on one side, so we start not infinitely far, we start on one side of the crossing and we end up on the other side symmetrically. And we try to optimize a process using Krotov in which we start in the ground state and we end up in the ground state after the crossing. And what we do is we run Krotov and for different giving, just varying the target time, okay? So I'm telling Krotov, I'm trying to get to the ground state on one side of the crossing, to the ground state on the other side, in a time 1.50 in inverse of the splitting, basically. It is not exactly that, but...
Your coupling is constant, right?
Sorry? My coupling is constant in this case, yes. So what I'm varying is just the position on the... So I have my Landau-Zener situation, okay, this is constant. And what I'm varying is just... you know, the position in my parameter is the tuning, if you like. Okay. This is just a toy model, as I said. It is more or less useless, and it has just the only purpose of being a case in which one can there exist estimates of the speed in which you can do that process. And I would like to see whether I can reach that limit using Krotov. And especially if Krotov can tell me if I have a heuristic, some heuristic procedure, like optimizing. When you optimize, you know, you often try to, you know, you get some curve. You have number of iterations. Okay, this is everyone's experience. In some cases, you know, as the iterations grow, your error goes down, and you are happy. In some cases, your error settles to something which is not really zero, and you are unhappy. And the question I'm asking myself here is, assuming that I'm doing it as good as it gets, am I really hitting some, you know, hard wall? The fact that I'm not converging to zero comes from the fact that I'm hitting some hard wall, or maybe I'm not clever enough. And here is a system which is as simple as possible. So, you know, I can be quite confident that there is no trick to be played. And so, and I go to a very high number of Krotov iterations, 10 to the 5, for such a simple system is almost, you know, crazy to do that. And I can see that there are curves which, you know, appear to point downwards. And there are curves which appear to not point downwards. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out a heuristic criterion, how to, you know, distinguish, how to tell at a certain number of iterations, which is arbitrary, okay? I choose a number of iterations. I do it for a long time. Then I say, okay, what criterion can I give myself to decide whether this is going to converge or not? And the stupid criterion that came to my mind is, you know, the curvature of these curves in logarithmic scale. Okay, because it looks like these curves up here are, you know, have a positive curvature, and these have a negative curvature. And this one here, you know, seems, it gives me the impression that it will go straight, let's say. So I'm trying to, and this is as, you know, rude, rough as I am telling you, okay? I'm just plotting the curvature of these curves in this logarithmic plot as a function of the number of iterations. And I see that there are some curves for which this goes below zero and some for which this stays up to zero. And, you know, I'm varying around. This is the quantum speed limit predicted by this paper here in 83, based on the overlap between the initial and final wave function and the r cosine of that. So it's an analytic function, which has been studied more than 20 years ago. And it gives this curve as a function of this, basically the starting point, because for different starting points, the ground state has a different projection on the real state that you want to get at the end. And here are the estimates which I get from my second derivative criterion.
Excuse me, you want to go to another state, or you want to stay in one state?
I want to stay in the same state.
So you want to be adiabatic, right?
No, I want to stay in the same state, even though I am two orders of magnitude faster than adiabatic, because I'm doing this in a time which is of the order of this splitting here, right?
Yeah, I understand that, but your goal was to be in the ground state, back to the ground
state. I'm saying that I am not adiabatic in the sense that I am going to require that I am in the ground state at the end, but
this
being adiabatic,
ground state.
This is not the definition of adiabatic, because the definition of adiabatic is that I stay in the instantaneous state connected to the one which I started from.
Yeah,
so if I was adiabatic, I would stay here. Instead, what I require is that I'm going here, but in the meantime, I can be anywhere.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm telling you that final state which you're going to be, it's not your ground state on initial basis.
No,
it is the ground state of the system. It is the state in which the system ended if it evolved adiabatically from the initial ground state.
So if you don't have omega, so how the states are going to be?
If omega is zero, then this thing will cross.
Yes, this is the ground state, your initial basis.
This is the ground state in my initial basis, and it will be
the
excited state in the
basis.
Yes, it will be.
So you're not going to be in the ground state, you're going to be in the excited state.
I'm going to be in the ground state of a quantum system is defined as the state which has the minimal energy.
Okay.
What is the state that has the minimal energy at this point? It is this one. What is the state that has the minimal energy at this point? It is this one. Okay? If I have an adiabatic transition, I'm going from this state to this state.
Right. So
this is so trivial that it may seem... is it unusual?
Okay.
Oh, goodness. I think
this is an unusual confusion between adiabatic and diabatic, but I think you explained yourself clearly.
I think one can read it on several kinds of quantum mechanics books.
I don't know what is clear here, but if you draw the just pure state without coupling, so you will see that you have a ground state, you have an excited state. Right? At the end of your moving trajectory is the final time.
Correct.
You're talking about the ground in the diabetic basis in case.
No, I'm not talking about any basis.
No, you are talking about an adiabatic process which would take place in the absence of coupling. Adiabaticity is a concept that refers to time evolution according to a specified Hamiltonian. So if I specify my Hamiltonian in terms of a Hamiltonian having a non-zero coupling here, an adiabatic process is the one which takes me from here to there. If I specify my system in terms of a system that has no coupling, the adiabatic process will be that this system will stay in there. Right?
So which basis do you choose?
I choose the basis defined by the system that I have shown in the previous transparency, which is this system, and the basis is these two eigenstates of which I have plotted here the energy. So when we found this, we were surprised, because, you know, the criterion that I described to you to find the quantum speed limit for this system is the most heuristic thing that I can think of. Okay? And still, so I would not believe that it should give anything meaningful. Okay? But still, because it just depends on how you optimize, how you deal with it. But nevertheless, you have a feeling. When you have a student, and you twist the neck of this student, okay, in such a way that he or she really plays appropriately with all the lambda parameters of your optimization, and then the student comes crying to you and says, "I cannot do any better," you have the feeling that there is something physical in there, right? Don't you? So, I mean, here I'm just trying to make that feeling quantitative. And I'm dreaming, let's say, because really I have no basis for that, I'm dreaming that this can even be predictive in such a way that, you know, if I optimize and I hit some hard walls, I will say, look, maybe this hard wall I'm hitting has, you know, some connection to the quantum speed limit for this system.
Tomas, and do you get the same estimate for this derivative independent of your initial guess?
Yes. We also check that. And this refers to this bars here, okay? Because we did like hundreds of runs, and this is why we picked the simple system, because a run can last, you know, can be very quick. So we are trying to.
Yes. Now we have to worry about time because
yes,
15,
sure.
15 minutes. There's.
No, this is a good point to stop, really.
Okay.
Because it was okay.
So before, first of all. And first of all, at 12:15,